So I'm going to talk about the statistics of field fluctuations in Euclidean anti-de Sitter space and de Sitter space. In particular, I'm going to be interested in the manner in which sort of early fluctuations in de Sitter space, or IR fluctuations in ADS, are encoded in the statistics of configurations near the boundary in ADS, or at late time in de Sitter space. And a theme that's going to emerge is that initial perturbations are never encoded locally, and they're sometimes, but not always, encoded globally. So that's sort of a funny statistical thing, that no patch of future infinity in de Sitter space has any memory of the initial perturbation, but if you put them all together, you find that there can be. And I found this a little counterintuitive, so I'm going to begin in the first 15 or 20 minutes describing, in the simple context of Markov systems on a tree, how that can happen, how the statistics, how that works. Then I'm going to do some calculations with free field theory in Euclidean ADS and de Sitter space. And then the last sort of 15 or 20 minutes will be some thoughts about the implications of this memory, this global memory of initial conditions for the space of configurations in de Sitter space. So we're going to start off with Markov systems and the definition. I'm going to make a definition of memory. So we say in a system with a Markov update rule, memory is the existence of a correlation between the initial state and the state after infinitely many generations. So it doesn't have to be a large correlation, but it has to be a finite correlation between the state of the system after u generations and the initial condition. That has to attend to a finite non-zero limit as u goes to infinity. And if that's the case, I'll say that the system has memory. And if it's not the case, I'll say the system does not have memory. So it's actually, I mean.
What is the Markov update rule?
I will give an example of that, and you'll see it in a moment. So first I'm going to illustrate why it's sort of never the case that you have memory. Why memory never really exists in Markov systems. So the simplest example, let's take a Markov system on a. There's a hockey stick somewhere. Yeah.
So the no memory means really the infinite time limit. It's not the correlation drop off faster than some rate.
Yeah. So if they're going to zero, then there's never any memory. If they tend to a finite limit, then I'm going to say the non-zero limit. I'll say there's memory. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So we take a system where the variables of the system are indexed by an integer, so we think about them as living on a one-dimensional line, and at each location we can have a variable. The simplest case, it can take one of two values, binary variable, let's say white and black. And a Markov update rule on this system says you specify an initial probability distribution for the two possible states at this site zero. And then we update the probability of site n plus 1 by matrix multiplication for the probability at generation u. And I guess the simplest non-trivial example is a sort of flip a Markov matrix, which takes the variable and flips it with probability gamma. So white turns into black with probability gamma, and white stays white with probability 1 minus gamma. So gamma is some real number between 0 and 1. And this system here never has memory. And you can show that really simply just by starting off with a probability distribution for the initial site, which is, let's say, definitely black. Okay, probability for black is 1, probability for white is 0. And we compute the probability distribution for the uth variable after u generations of this Markov process, u applications of the Markov matrix, just by taking powers of the matrix. We do that is by going to an eigenvector basis. And there's a contribution from the leading eigenvector, which has eigenvalue 1. That's the attractor, which is sort of a maximally uncertain 50-50 distribution for white and black. And then there's a subleading transient proportional to the second eigenvector of that matrix. And it decays exponentially. This is the second eigenvalue. 1 minus 2 gamma is the second eigenvalue of that matrix. And we just take the uth power of that. And if gamma is between 0 and 1, then the absolute value of this thing is less than 1, and the transient just fades away exponentially. So this is an example of a system with no memory, right? After as u goes to infinity, the probability distribution for the variable at generation u just completely decouples from the initial condition. There's an attractor. And there was nothing special here, actually, about the two-state system. This is true for any gapped Markov system. In general, you would have an expansion here in the eigenvectors of the Markov matrix, and this the leading contribution would be the second eigenvector. And if there's a gap between that and one, then there's no memory. There's another way to present this system, mathematically equivalent, which will be useful in what follows, which is to think about it as a statistical mechanics system. This Markov matrix is a transfer matrix solution for the statistical mechanics of a 1D Ising chain, which means we take the Boltzmann ensemble for a collection of spins indexed by the integers with a Hamiltonian that's, you know, the nearest neighbor interaction on this graph. So with a coupling J, you can relate J to gamma using this equation here. And in this language, what we computed on the previous slide using this Markov matrix was just the spin-spin correlation function. So it was the correlation function between the value of the spin at site 0, the value of the spin at site u, and we showed that decays exponentially in u with a rate that depends on gamma, or in other words, depends on the Ising coupling j. And the point of the previous slide in this context is just that the correlation function goes to 0. It's cluster decomposition. It goes to 0 as we take u to infinity, and the statistics for the spin very far away completely decouple from the spin at site 0. Okay, so far, I hope this has been pretty boring. I mean, there's been no memory at all, and it sort of seems completely natural that there's never any memory, and it's true for Markov systems on a line. There's never memory. So, okay, what we're going to do is make this hopefully interesting by studying it on a tree, where we can think about this in either of the two previous ways, the Markov or the statistical mechanics. We can think about this by starting out with some Markov system on this tree where we specify the probability distribution here at the root. And then through any path through the tree, we use the same Markov update rule. Yeah?
So what happens in
quantum
mechanics? What? Is that the system that you were considering before?
Yeah.
They all have real probability. So, what about if you have a system which is
well, we'll actually do an. We'll see an example of that later. De Sitter space is a quantum mechanical. The field theorem De Sitter space is a quantum mechanical system. So we'll discuss that. You can apply a similar logic there. So ask me the question again if you're not happy at the end of the when we discuss De Sitter space. But so far, you're right. This is classical probability. We're just doing Markov update rules with classical probability. Okay. Right. So as I said, you can think about this just as a Markov process along each path through the tree with the same structure as the 1D system. Or you can think about it as a statistical mechanics problem on a tree graph, right, where the nearest neighbors are defined by proximity on the tree. And now we want to ask the same question. We want to define memory the same way. We set up an initial condition here, and then we look at the probability distribution at successively later generations in the tree. And then we ask, in the limit that goes to infinity, is there any correlation remaining with the root? And the previous slide proves that there's no correlation between any given leaf as u goes to infinity and the root. So the question is whether there can, despite that, be correlation between the collection of leaves and the root. Okay, and okay. We'll see the answer is yes, but I want to motivate why that can be true with some pictures. So I'm going to show you a simulation of this system on a tree that branches, instead of branching into two, it branches into four. It's easier to picture. So, okay, we start out with an initial condition that's black. And the way the update rule works is we want to divide this into four children. So we take it and we divide it like that into four subsquares. And then in each of the subsquares, we apply this Markov matrix. So with probability gamma, we flip the color from black to white. Okay, and I set gamma equals 0.05, and there's, I guess, a slightly unlikely event. One of the four of them changed color and became white. Now we do that again for each of these four subsquares, so independently. So we're going to get 16 subsquares, and one of those 16 flipped color. We keep going, and the thing sort of fills up with smaller and smaller squares. But it's still totally clear that the initial condition here was black. Of course, this is after six generations, not infinitely many. But you can see, I mean, the thing I want to motivate is that there's sort of a freeze-in effect happening here, which is that the black initial condition is sort of being frozen in, and we're adding these smaller and smaller squares on top. But you can tell the initial condition was black. You can actually also tell that in the first generation something made a transition to white, and so on and so forth. Okay, that's not.
So then you're not just keeping track of a single instance of the outcome of the Markov chain, but you're keeping track of all of the outcomes.
Well, this was just, I mean, the pictures I showed you here were just,
The idea of the tree is you're keeping track of all of the outcomes.
We're going to keep track of the probability distribution, right?
Exactly,
right.
For all of the outcomes.
Yeah, right. Yep, and then ask whether there's correlation in that ensemble. Okay, so from this picture, I want you to sort of imagine that it's plausible that there's memory and this freeze-in effect. But I want to also argue that, I'll argue more precisely later, but I want to argue with pictures that there could be a transition as a function of gamma, where this was gamma equals 0.05, and it's pretty clear the initial condition here was white. But as we increase gamma, the probability of flipping colors, you sort of lose that, and this nice frozen-in IR structure sort of gives way to this, I don't know, UV-dominated noise. And it's, at least to my eye, pretty unclear here whether the initial condition was white or black. Okay, so now I want to be just slightly more precise about this and show that there is argue slightly more convincingly that there is a transition. And one way you could do that, the way that we'll do that here, is you make up a variable as a function of u. And then argue that variable in the limit u goes to infinity is still correlated with the root. So right, one bad strategy would be to use just one of the spins at generation u. We saw using the one-dimensional Markov chain that has no memory. So okay, that doesn't work. A better idea is to use, let's say, the majority vote. We'll make a variable which says count up all the white and black squares, and if there's more white than black, we guess the initial condition was white. If there's more black than white, we guess it was black. And then we want to see if we guess right more than half of the time. If we do, then that will show that there is memory in this. There's correlation between this variable at u goes to infinity and the root. So let's use this majority vote strategy and see how that works. So after u generations in this tree, there are p to the u spins, p to the u of these binary variables, where p is the branching number of the tree. It was 4 in the simulation I showed you. It was 2 in the drawing of the tree. So now we take a census of these things, and we want to think about the probability distribution for the number of black minus number of white squares. Let's suppose that the initial condition was black. We want to think about the probability distribution for the number of black minus the number of white squares. So, and we basically computed this a few slides ago in the one-dimensional model for a given spin, and it decayed as a power of the eigenvalue lambda to the u. It was 1 minus gamma to the u. But here we have p to the u of those, and we add those up. So the expected bias, the expected number of black minus white squares, if we start out with a black initial condition, is lambda p to the u. You might be tempted to think that means that if as long as lambda is greater than 1 over p, that there's always memory, because the expectation value of this thing grows exponentially. But that's too quick. The reason is that, I mean, if you think about, I don't know, maybe let me draw a picture over here. It's not a very interesting picture, so don't worry too much if you can't see it. If the distribution is what we showed here was that the center of the distribution for this quantity, number black minus number white, is off center. It's moved somewhere else, so the center is at some positive value. But if the width of the distribution is extremely large, parametrically larger than this shift, you know, some very wide distribution, then this shift is insignificant. On the other hand, if the width is narrow, then this shift is significant. So really the right thing to do is to compare the bias in the distribution to the square root of the variance in order to see if this is actually a significant correlation. You can also just think about this as normalizing this variable. And so, okay, the way we play this game is we assume that there's no memory, so that the different patches of the system are basically statistically independent. So then the variance should grow like the number of variables, and the square root of the variance grows like square root of p to the u. And now we just compare these. We compare the bias, so the shift in the distribution, to the width of the distribution. And all right, so we take u to infinity, and if lambda is bigger than 1 over root p, then the bias wins, and there's memory. If lambda is less than 1 over root p, then the bias loses, and there's no memory. So, okay, good. This argument was, you know, it was a little bit hand-wavy, but you can sharpen this into a completely rigorous argument. And in fact, it has been, there. It turns out there's a fairly large amount of statistical mechanics, there's mathematical literature where this is rigorously proven. This lambda equals 1 over square root of p transition. Okay. No, so no, it's not. That would be like, well, I guess you have to define exactly which, because here both white and black are expanding, so it's not quite like an eternal inflation setup where, you know, only one of the two colors would be expanding. But even apart from that, that type of transition is more related to a lambda p greater than one transition. It's not a lambda square root p greater than one transition. Yeah.
To what extent do you define this memory? So how much you should go forward to do this memory? So this memory should define, this should be with some quantitative definition.
Well, yeah, this, so good. By memory, I mean after infinitely many generations. It does not go away. There's a finite correlation that remains after infinitely many generations.
But in your previous slide, if you continue your steps up to infinity, I think the left-hand side, you choose lambda 0.05, something.
Yes,
like that.
Yes.
So that should be a uniform, and that's what I'm guessing.
Yeah. What are you guessing? This.
If you continue to infinity, so then you get something like the right-hand side.
Yeah.
Gets completely uniform.
So great. This is great because that's exactly why I wanted to use. That's not true. That's actually not true. What will happen is that if you look at any patch, so if you focus on any spin, the probability distribution for that spin at very late u will become independent of the initial condition. And I think that's sort of what your intuition is suggesting, and that's correct. But what is not correct is that the collection of spins will lose their correlation with the initial condition. And it's counterintuitive, but it's true. And
I'm thinking that the simple condensed matter models, for instance, if you have a spin, and then if you have some blocks of the spin, and in the some metal, and then you increase the heat. So it's like increasing the heat, and you let this spin to fluctuate up and down. And then after a while, you can't recognize that your initial. So everything, everywhere will be thermalized, and there will be no correlation. Okay. So it's like in the thermodynamics.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe the best thing I can say is that's an imperfect analogy because that is not what happens here. There is locally no memory of the initial condition, but globally, this global census, number of white minus number of black, does remain correlated with the initial condition. Yeah?
It all depends on the depends on how much non-Gaussianity there is. Purely Gaussian, random. There's no memory.
Well, no, that's not. So we'll do actually later a Gaussian example. We'll do an example with Gaussian field theory in hyperbolic space, which is analogous to this tree, and there is memory there for depending on parameters. Yeah.
I think what you're saying is that in the end, it will have some shade of gray if you want to look at it, and as opposed to being.
I think it's worth because you put a lot of tiny white dots, but there still are many more black dots.
Yeah. Good. So the fractional excess of black over minus white grows slower than the volume, but it still exponentially increases. I mean, it grows like lambda p to the u instead of the number of sites, which grows like p to the u. But it still grows absolutely. So it's a small fractional excess of black over white, but it's a large numerical excess. That's lambda is the second eigenvalue of the Markov matrix, which defines the evolution on the tree.
What about non-Markovian behavior?
So, well, I'm sort of explicitly restricting myself to that case, which is enough to include any statistical mechanics problem you want to define on the tree. Okay, so good. So that's the first part of the talk. And the second part, I want to apply this and look for a transition, a memory, no memory transition. This lambda equals 1 over square root of p transition for fluctuating field dynamics and Euclidean ADS and De Sitter space. The reason you might think there could be an analogy is just the geometric parallel of the spaces. You can think about a tree as sort of a discrete approximation to the hyperbolic space. This is a drawing that's supposed to illustrate that. So, okay, good. So we'll start with Euclidean ADS, or hyperbolic space. And the setup that we want to do is basically the same thing. We're going to put a boundary condition for the field at some finite distance in the tree, which is like the root. And then we'll look at the statistics of the field near the boundary of hyperbolic space. We won't look at sort of just the local statistics. We'll look at some global average. The local statistics in the previous example decoupled from the initial condition, but these global averages don't. Okay, so let's set that calculation up. I'm going to use Poincaré slicing of Euclidean ADS. So here's the metric. Z equals 0 is the boundary. And you can sort of imagine a tree lives in this space. That's the geometric parallel, is a tree lives in this space here. So to make things simple, and because we're focusing on these homogeneous majority vote quantities, we'll focus on the 0 mode. And the wave equation for a massive scalar field, the zero mode of a massive scalar field, has these two simple power law solutions, z to the delta and z to the d minus delta, where delta is related to the mass of the field. And what we want to do is we want to set up a problem where we fix the value of the field at some radius z equals l prime. And then we want to look at the probability distribution at a smaller value of z equals l. And we want to take l to 0 and look at the probability distribution and see if it's correlated with the value that we fix at l prime. Okay, so there's a subtlety in studying these, in general, studying statistical mechanics on a exponentially expanding space, which is we have to be careful with the boundary conditions. And in this case, there are two sort of maximally symmetric choices of boundary conditions for the field theory, the so-called standard boundary conditions, where we set to 0 the coefficient of z to the d minus delta at the boundary, and the alternate boundary conditions, where we set to 0 the coefficient of z to the delta. So we're going to do these two. You have a question? So we're studying Euclidean field theory in hyperbolic space, which is a statistical mechanics system on hyperbolic space, and the way we're going to evaluate the probability distributions is by doing Euclidean path integrals. And those path integrals can be evaluated using the classical solution, using the solutions to the differential equation. That's why I care about the solutions to the differential equation. But it's not, we're not just studying the differential equations on the space. We're studying the fluctuating dynamics of a field on the space using those differential solutions to the differential equation.
So you have a Markovian process in mind, right? And you say that that leads to some thermal, the outcome or the moments of that Markovian process are the same as some thermal system. Is that
good. So on the tree, that was infinitely precise. It's true that any statistical mechanics problem with a Boltzmann weighting can be phrased in terms of a Markov update rule, just a transfer matrix solution. On hyperbolic space, it's a little bit more complicated. But one thing that you could do, and that Dan and I did in detail, was to study a massive Gaussian field on a tree graph, where there is literally a Markov update rule, which is equivalent to just the Gaussian path integral on the tree. I mean, yeah. It's not as simple because in continuous Euclidean space, it's not quite as simple because there's not a discrete sort of update step where the variable generation U depends only on sort of its ancestor in this tree-like way. But, which is why we're not going to analyze it that way. We'll do it more directly. Okay, so let me do the standard boundary conditions first. So there, to compute the conditional probability for the field variable at radius L, given a fixed Dirichlet condition at L prime, and with the standard boundary conditions phi proportional to z to the delta at the boundary, we do a path integral over the space, again, just the zero mode, with Dirichlet conditions here and there, and the standard boundary conditions there. The path integral can be evaluated by evaluating the classical action on the classical solutions, evaluating the action on the classical solutions. And the resulting conditional probability distribution is Gaussian. And it's a shifted Gaussian. So here we have this phi L at radius L, which is like the number of black minus white. It's sort of this, it's a homogeneous zero mode, sort of like a census variable. And its distribution is shifted away from center by the fixed value phi L prime. But as L tends to zero, the shift vanishes like L to the delta. So the bias in this distribution is like L to the delta, and the square root of the variance we get by taking the square root of the denominator is like L to the d over 2, and delta is always greater than or equal to d over 2. So the bias vanishes faster than the square root of the variance, and we conclude that there's no memory. The probability distribution completely decouples for the value of the field at L goes to zero, given the value of the field at L prime. That's standard quantization. In alternate quantization, the story is basically identical, except you put different boundary conditions at z goes to zero. Again, we do the path integral by evaluating on the classical solution. And now the bias, the shift in this distribution is proportional to L to the d minus delta instead of L to the delta. And the square root of the variance is like, again, L to the d minus delta. You get that by multiplying these factors together and taking the square root. And so the bias and the square root of the variance are order one related. They are comparable. And so there's significant correlation. It's like a distribution which has been moved off center by an amount which is of order its width, which has an order one amount of information in it. In fact, okay, we can be more precise by computing mutual information rather than just doing this sort of hand-wavy variance, bias divided by square root of variance argument. Compute the joint probability distribution and compute the mutual information as a difference of entropies. And we find, and this is also for general Fourier mode, K, and we find that as the radius L approaches zero, the standard quantization curve tends to zero, whereas the alternate quantization curve tends to some finite value, where there's memory.
Sorry, is this including
thing which I could also equally include, just be a class.
Did you say, is this including?
So is this the dominant classical thing, or is this part of the mechanical fluctuations on top of it?
So it's a Euclidean problem. So it's a Euclidean statistical, it's a statistical mechanics on hyperbolic space with fluctuating field. Yeah, this is the exact answer for a free field. There, no approximations were made in this computation. Again.
Yeah, so I'm confused. Right, so at least dominated by the classical thing. So I'm confused how this can be true, because I would have said, okay, we know that classical problem is that if I specify the particular and if I specify the boundary condition of infinity, the solution is determined. There's no free field left. And so I can do this.
Yeah, that's not the question that I was answering using the classical solution. What I was using the classical solution for was to evaluate a path integral. So
that's going to be dominated by the classical.
Well, but it's exact. It's not just dominant. I mean, for Gaussian theory, it's exactly given by the classical action.
That's fine, but at least the answers have to at least one degree in the same
way. Yeah, I guess I'm not exactly sure what you're saying. I mean, here you don't see this variance quantity in the classical expression. I mean, that has to do with the size of the fluctuation. So I'm not actually sure how to answer this question just using the solutions to the differential equation, except by using them to compute the probability distribution, which is what we did. Okay. Another thing you can plot is just for the alternate boundary conditions, the dependence on the dimension, and the only point I want to make about this graph is that the amount of mutual information, the memory, goes to zero at both edges of the alternate quantization window. We knew it had to go to zero at this side because it's the same as the standard quantization, but it's a little curious that it also goes to zero over here, and I don't understand exactly why that's the case. Yeah. Well, in this case, I was actually imposing a Dirichlet condition. I was imposing a Dirichlet condition on the field. This was a Euclidean path. I was imposing an initial state, if you like, which was a Dirichlet condition for the field at L prime. And then I was doing the path integral. This is a completely well-defined path integral in this region here. Dirichlet condition, and then sort of a Neumann-like condition at the boundary. I don't know the initial. If you like, this is like a specification of the x variable. Okay, so now I want to do the same thing. We found in ADS there's this transition, depending on standard and alternate boundary conditions. I want to do the same thing in De Sitter space, and we could basically do the same thing with probability distributions, but instead, what I want to do is sort of draw a tree on top of the space and argue by analogy, where we set up the root of the tree. It's like a t equals zero slice, global coordinates for De Sitter, and then I want to ask about the correlations between the value of the field here, and some global average of the field at late time, and run the same argument as we did in the tree Markov case. So, okay, in expanding sphere coordinates, the correlation function at time t and time zero decays like e to the minus delta minus t in De Sitter space, where this is a definition of delta minus in general, but for free fields, delta minus is, you can compute it, it's related to the mass. So that's very much like the decay of the correlation along a particular branch in the tree, the Markov problem. But what we should do is we should multiply that by the number of different Hubble patches, by the spatial volume up here, which grows exponentially with time. And we find a total correlation between t equals zero and t equals, you know, t, which goes like n times this correlator, which is e to the d minus delta minus times t. And you compare that to the square root of the number of patches, square root of n, is e to the d over 2t, you find that this beats that if delta minus is less than d over 2. In other words, if the correlation decays sufficiently slowly, less than d over 2, then this bias beats the square root of the variance. This calculation is exactly the same. I mean, the way that you would set up the calculation for the probability distribution is a little bit different because it's a quantum mechanical system and we have to set up some wave packet at t equals zero, basically for the reason that you were saying earlier. But this correlation argument is exactly the same. Okay, so we conclude that if delta minus is less than d over 2, there's memory, and if it's more than d over 2, there's not.
There is a big difference, so that here you're doing unitary quantum mechanics.
Yeah, good. I'm going to address that. So, right, as you said, there's a little bit of a puzzle, which is that we're looking at the quantum mechanics of a homogeneous mode, and that unitarity applies mode by mode, and it tells you the information doesn't really have anywhere to go. And if it starts out in the S wave, the perturbation will have some overlap with the homogeneous mode, and it has to stay there for all time. So, right, so you've suggested a proof that for free fields, there's always memory in De Sitter space. And actually, that's true. That for free fields, delta minus is always less than or equal to d over 2. So that's consistent. There's a branch cut in the dimension formula, and as you increase the mass, the real part of delta minus never exceeds d over 2. So that's consistent. But it's interesting to note that for interacting fields, delta minus can be greater than d over 2. This was shown by Maroff and Morrison and by some people from PITP, Jatkar, LeBlanc, and Rajaraman. And so it suggests in general that there is not memory in these simple homogeneous quantities. And that's, again, that's consistent with unitarity because for an interacting field theory, it's not true the information stays in the homogeneous mode. It gets sort of scrambled up in a way that would require a very complicated sort of, I don't know, quantum coherent measurement or something, not something that's visible in these simple integrated quantities. Okay. So that's good. That's the end of the perturbative field theory in Euclidean ADS and De Sitter space discussion. So for the next, I don't know, 15 or so minutes, I want to discuss some implications of this memory, the global memory thing. And one way to make that somewhat sharp is to think for a minute about eternal inflation, where we have a very large number of very low dimension fields. So eternal inflation, we imagine a landscape with large number of metastable vacua, which are connected by tunneling transitions. So then we can define fields, which are basically indicator functions for the value of the local vacuum, which tells you whether you're in the orange vacuum, which might be this minimum here. Well, I guess that's the red one because it's zero, but the orange vacuum here or the blue one here. And you have one field of that type for each value of the for each of the minima, for each vacuum, and the dimension, the rate at which that the correlation decays with time is extremely slow, because tunneling transitions are very rare. So if you start out with a blue initial condition, it's likely to stay blue for a very long time. So the rate of relaxation is like e to the minus the tunneling action, the Coleman-DeLucia tunneling action. So again, we have this funny situation where, you know, it's part of the lore of eternal inflation, and it's true that the local properties at late time become independent of the initial conditions, but we see that global properties late time retain not only some correlation with the initial conditions, but basically a perfect record. I mean, if this dimension is very small, so it's like those black and white squares pictures I showed you, but with gamma instead of 0.05 being like e to the minus 10 to the 30, so the freeze-in effect is basically perfect. I mean, you have, at late times, just a perfect record, not only of the initial condition, but of the entire transition history. Even though, in any patch, there's no dependence on the initial conditions at all. So, okay, that's sort of a funny situation for the configuration at a given time to encode the entire past history of the dynamics. So I'd like to understand better what that means for the space of configurations, and I'm going to show you sort of one thing that I think it means, and we'll do the little calculation. But I don't. I think there might be more to say about this. Okay, so one way to phrase this problem is in terms of mathematics of extreme states and the tail field, which is, I don't know, it's statistics jargon. The tail field, if you have an infinite system and a probability distribution for that system, the tail field is a collection of events which don't depend on any finite number of variables. So an example of that is, you know, there are more black than white squares at u equals infinity. If you change any finite number of the squares, you won't change the fact that there are more black than white. So that's a tail measurable point. It's a tail event. And so so these memory type quantities, these global census type quantities, are related to these tail events. And an extreme state is defined as a sub-ensemble of a probability ensemble in which all tail events have probability either 0 or 1. So there's definitely more black than white, or there's definitely more white than black. And we showed earlier the existence of memory implies that the ensemble at late times is not extreme. It's not an extreme ensemble, because these quantities, more black than white, have correlation with the initial condition. And you can't have correlation with something if your probability distribution is either 0, you know, is completely determined. The probability is either 0 or 1. So what this means is that the probability distribution for the configurations at late time splits up into a bunch of different extreme states. You can always decompose a distribution into a sum. In this case, I guess it would be an uncountable sum of distinct extreme states. And these extreme states correspond. I mean, these are sort of a mathematically precise form of splitting the ensemble up into it had a black initial condition or it had a white initial condition, just using the configuration at late time. So I want to argue that these extreme states are sort of the manner in which this transition history is encoded in the late time, in the space of configurations. And okay, so one thing about this decomposition is that it's hierarchical, right? The evolution in the bulk is hierarchical. The transition history is hierarchical. A bubble nucleates within another bubble. So the pattern, you know, the pattern of these white and black splotches at future infinity is sort of organized in this hierarchical fashion, suggests a hierarchical organization of the extreme states. And one diagnostic for hierarchical organization like that is this phenomenon known as ultrametricity has been important in spin glasses, and has also been studied recently by Dio Eninos and Frederick Deneff. An ultrametric structure is a metric on a space for which all triangles are tall isosceles, and these things naturally arise in spaces that are hierarchically organized, like gene sequences or distances on trees, or, I don't know, like certain metrics on words and so on. So we'd like to see this hierarchical organization of extreme states suggests an ultrametric structure for the configuration space at late time in De Sitter space. And in fact, something that was actually pointed out, that was, as I said, pointed out recently by Eninos and Deneff, who studied exactly this question for massless fields in De Sitter space. And what they did was they studied the Hartle-Hawking on the Bunch-Davies vacuum in De Sitter space, and they independently drew configurations, spatial field configurations, phi1, phi2, phi3, and they computed an L2 type distance between those configurations, and they then computed the probability distribution for the distances, and found that it peaks on isosceles triangles, as you would expect an ultrametric distance function to do. But the thing I'm suggesting is that, or that Dan Roberts and I are suggesting, is that this ultrametricity has to do with memory, and that it shouldn't just be restricted to the massless case, which is pathological for a variety of reasons. We want to separate this ultrametric effect from the pathology of the massless scalar field. So we studied this for finite mass. Okay, just to check that this ultramatricity extends beyond what Paninos and Deneff studied. So we have to do that, you have to redefine the what you mean by the distance to account for the fact that all fields, massive fields in de Sitter space, decay at late time. This is sort of the same type of factor. You strip off bulk fields in ADS to define boundary operators. Okay, so you define a new distance that way, and then subtract the mean to get a distance which is finite, which is a finite probability distribution. It can be positive or negative. And then we want to compute the probability distribution for this distance. So the way it works is you draw two field configurations from the Hartle-Hawking ensemble. You can compute their distances, L2 distance between them. The goal is to write down the probability distribution for that distance, where we're summing over different field configurations. Yeah. Yeah.
So is this really just a property of Gaussian wave functions?
Great.
Is there a direct connection?
No. It is not, and we'll see that. Yeah. Good. Okay, so it's hard to compute the probability distribution directly, but it's easy to compute these exponential moments. So e to the minus s times the distribution, and to take the expectation over field configurations with the Hartle-Hawking weighting. We do path integral. The two field configurations that we draw from the wave function ensemble, which is this term here, that's the square of the Hartle-Hawking wave function, where beta, you compute that, it depends on time, and the wave number k. And then to put this term in, we just add the Fourier transform of this distance to the exponential here. You could do the path integral, it's a determinant. A product of determinants, one for each mode. That's the answer. You can compute that. And then to compute the probability distribution, we need to Laplace transform this to recover, you know, p of delta from expectation value of e to the minus s delta. Yeah. Good. Phi 1 and phi 2 are spatial field configurations at time t. So they depend on the d spatial coordinates of de Sitter space. And the distance between them, we're fixing t here, and then the distance between phi 1 and phi 2 is a spatial integral of the difference of the fields squared. It's an L2 distance of the configurations at a given time. Sorry?
The x is in the same position?
This is the same x, but we're integrating it. The same position here, x and x, but we're integrating over all space. So yeah, if you think about the field configuration as a vector in the space of positions, then this is an L2 norm of an L2 distance between those vectors. Yeah. Okay, so right, you can compute this. And then Laplace transform it numerically. And for different values of the dimension, you can compute different curves. So if delta minus equals 0, this distribution is, that's the massless case that Aninos and Deneff studied. You get this nice gumbell distribution.
What is the delta?
This is good. Small delta is the distance with the mean subtracted.
Yeah.
So this is the probability for the distance. Yeah, it can be positive or negative just because you've subtracted the mean. And it's some asymmetric function of the distance. As you increase delta, the asymmetry goes away. It's hard to tell from these graphs, but maybe you can see it. The asymmetry goes away, and you end up actually exactly with a Gaussian at d over 4. So this is a partial answer to your question, but it'll become clear in a minute. Right, so for delta minus greater than or equal to d over 4, you can compute this Laplace transform exactly. And it's literally a Gaussian. But really what we want to do is compute the probability distribution for three of these distances, where we draw three configurations from the Hartle-Hawking ensemble. And to check for ultramatricity, I'll plot a conditional probability with two of the distances fixed. I'm going to fix one of the distances to be 2, that's this dashed line, and the other distance to be minus 3, is this dashed line. So this is a case where sort of these are unusually close, and these are unusually far, and these are unusually close. And then you plot the conditional probability for the third distance. We fix two legs of the triangle, and we're plotting the conditional probability for the third leg. And in an ultrametric world where all triangles are tall isosceles, the length of the third leg would be equal to the maximum of the length of the other two. So there would be a delta function here at 2. And for the massless case, I don't know, it's pretty close. It's a sharply peaked distribution, rather close to the longer distance. As we increase delta, the distribution is continuous. There's nothing special that happens at m equals 0. But this ultrametricity sort of fades. And by the time you reach delta equals d over 4, again, you can compute the probability distribution exactly. And it's Gaussian. It's a Gaussian distribution with no ultrametricity, no preference for the isosceles. So that's, I hope, an answer to your question. It's not, the ultrametricity is not just about Gaussian fields. Here we have a control parameter, which takes us from this ultrametric regime to at delta over 4, a case where there's sort of quantifiably no ultrametricity.
How does this probability look like in this ultrametric regime? This is
the probability in the non-ultrametric regime.
What would it be in the ultrametric regime?
Well, I can compute it numerically by Laplace transform. I can't write a formula for you, but here are graphs.
But you said it peaks at the isosceles.
Yeah, so to check that, what I plotted here was a conditional probability given that two of the legs of the triangle are fixed. So if the distribution favors isosceles triangles, then it will want the third leg to be equal to the maximum of the other two. And so we fix one distance to be 2, one distance to be -3. And in this sort of ultrametric regime, indeed, the distribution wants the third leg to be approximately 2. The definition of an ultrametric metric is one for which all triangles are tall isosceles. Are isosceles triangles where the equal lengths are the longer lengths. OK, good. So actually, I'm done. I want to sum up. So I started out by reviewing this rather well-studied transition in statistical mechanics between memory and absence of memory. We did that for thinking about an Ising model or a general Markov system on a tree. And then we saw that there's a corresponding transition for the statistical mechanics problem of field theory in Euclidean ADS. And indeed, this memory transition is perfectly correlated to the choice of standard versus alternate boundary conditions for the scalar field. In De Sitter space, by contrast, there's no transition for free fields. Free fields always have memory, and there's sort of a unitarity explanation for that. But interacting fields may not. I mean, the correlation argument suggests that they don't. And although we can't compute the probability distribution exactly because the theory is interacting, it seems likely that in general, interacting fields do not have memory. But for fields with memory, so very light, very low mass fields in De Sitter space, the mathematics implies this sort of hierarchical decomposition of the configuration space ensemble into these extreme states. And if delta is less than d over 4, this is visible. You can sort of confirm with this simple Anino-Denef diagnostic the existence of these extreme states, of this ultrametric hierarchical structure. OK, that's all. Thank you.
Basically, and they have this property that they're quasi-periodic, but there's, you know, there's an uncountably infinite number of different ways you can tile the plane, but if I give you any local patch, no matter how large, you can't tell which of those tilings you're on. And so it's one of these things where the information about the tiling is entirely, and which tiling you're talking about is contained globally. And then it's similar to this in the sense that you produce them. There's this algorithm for producing them, which is a lot like, which is it's actually called inflation, believe it or not. Which is you start with an initial tile and initial tiling, you produce you produce additional ones by in every local patch there's a rule, which is analogous to your Markov rule. Just it's not random; it's deterministic. Given any little patch there's a rule for replacing it by smaller diamonds with a certain pattern, and then you do that in every little patch, and you produce a new Penrose tiling that way, and you but with all the diamonds smaller, and then you do that again, and you get another, you iteratively produce all of the all of the guys this way. So it's but it has.
You said you cycle through all the different tilings by sort of going through the next generation, but not by changing the rules that generate.
Well, that's stronger than what I know. I don't know that for a given initial condition you get to all the tiles, but it sounds very much like the case that it sounds very analogous to this, but without need for any randomness in the Markov process that takes you from one node to the branches below it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll take a look. Thanks.
Tiling inflation has runaway fluctuations that come, so the universe becomes highly chaotic. Could you say this, you have an exact memory of that?
Well,
at the end.
Let's see, when you say there's runaway, could you comment a little bit about what you mean by that? It becomes chaotic, runaway fluctuations.
Because you have all these problems.
Yeah, and yeah.
The fluctuations become runaway. The whole thing becomes chaotic.
I mean, it becomes highly non-homogeneous. It becomes very non-homogeneous.
Exactly.
Yeah, where you have these different values of the vacuum and cosmological constant in different patches.
So on.
Yeah, but right. That's exactly the information that's encoded in these spatial slices in these very non-homogeneous patches of, you know, in these pictures. It's like the white and the black patches, and so it's that information that tells you. Yeah, exactly. That's the information that tells you about sort of the history of the history of the process that produced those.
What practical? What do I get away from? What do I go away from this? What knowledge do I go away with this practical cosmology? Planck mission.
Planck mission?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Maybe okay. This is sort of. This is sort of off the cuff. I mean, you could imagine computing these distributions. If you want to be really specific to Planck, you could imagine computing these distributions with Planck data, right? Looking for ultrametricity in the CMB. I'm not sure whether that would be particularly interesting.
Gaussian.
Well, this is a Gaussian theory, so.
I don't think anybody looks for this particular thing, but I'm not even sure whether one can look for
this. This doesn't require non-Gaussian. This was a Gaussian theory that produced these non-Gaussian distance distributions. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I would like to understand about this, I don't think you would call this a practical application, but I would like to understand better what the meaning is of the fact that the history is encoded in the configurations. That might be conceptually helpful for understanding some difficult problems in eternal inflation, like the measure problem and so on. It suggests that if you know the probability distribution on a slice, which is what some people who believe in DSCFT think that could be computed in principle exactly, then you can learn the probability distribution in a simple way for the bulk history. Yeah.
So does the existence of these extreme states, and I apologize, maybe you said this, but I wasn't here, depend on your rule for taking the senses? So for example, I can imagine the square picture is very akin to like calculating the fraction of Coulomb volume in different states, for example. And there are definitely what you get in the end depends on the initial condition very, 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 in very much detail. But I can imagine taking a different census where that doesn't happen, where really, you know, I would lose most, if not all, of the information about the initial state. So how, I guess, how dependent is this whole story on the precise way that you're doing the census?
Okay, let's see. Let me see if I understood. I'll say something. Maybe I'm not sure if it'll answer your question. So if it doesn't, ask me again, and I'll try. But the way in which you decompose the ensemble into extreme states, sort of the order in which you pull the ensemble apart into different extreme states, will of course depend upon how you define things like the census that you're using to decompose them. Like there were more black than white versus there were more white than black. And if you use a slightly differently shaped region, then the manner in which you split the ensemble apart will depend on that. But that the set of extreme states is well defined. It's some uncountably infinite set, which is well defined independently of the procedure that you use to sort of regulate that decomposition. Does that help?
Well, so I'm just imagining if you gave me some co-moving volume fraction at some late time, then looking at that. Maybe I could infer just something almost directly about what the initial condition could have possibly been in the rules for updating or whatever. But if I'm, for example, counting the physical volume in black versus white, then the thing I get in the end contains basically no information at all compared to what I had in the co-moving volume case. And it seems then very hard to go backwards and sort of reconstruct where I might have started.
Yeah, yes, you're right that if you don't look at right. If you don't look at the right thing, then you have no
how
hope.
How much of your calculation becomes, because you took the global, for example, slicing of the city, and you did the calculation in that foliation. But if I change the coordinate system or go to co-moving, that means you might be even at different foliation.
Well, yeah, I mean, this story will be qualitatively unchanged for any slicing of de Sitter space that's sort of global, that includes a full sort of co-moving patch. So global coordinates, or you could use hyperbolic slicing, or you could use flat slicing. The story will be qualitatively the same in all of those. It will be very different if we use, for example, static patch slicing or something of de Sitter space, where you're always restricted to a single Hubble patch. And there, the usual story about forgetting the initial conditions would apply. And you wouldn't have access to all of these different patches that make up the global slice.
I'm interested in inverse problems, and I see this as being related, in at least in an abstract sense, to those problems. Are there cases of systems that have memory where you can figure out the initial state without having all of the data from the end state?
Well,
in other words, the boundary's incomplete.
Yeah, so, okay. Good. So you can do. You can never perfectly figure out the initial state. You can construct a variable that has a very high correlation with the initial state using the full boundary if gamma is sufficiently small. But if we then restrict ourselves to half of t equals infinity or quarter or something, you just get a somewhat worse estimate of the initial value of the spin. I believe it's always true for any finite, for a hundredth of the boundary or a millionth, any finite fraction of the future boundary will have some correlation with the root if the full system. So if there's memory, then any finite region of the boundary, any finite co-moving region of the boundary will have some memory of the root. But it won't, the estimate you get for the initial condition won't be as good as if you used all the information. Yeah?
I just thought of a practical application.
Oh, that's great.
In the stock market.
That's too practical. I don't even
make a lot of money. In the stock market, there's something called the standard hypothesis, that the market is purely random, and there's no memory. So even though it's Gaussian, you're saying you could get a memory. So if I could get a memory in 5 minutes, I can make a lot of money.
Yeah, is the stock market a tree? I don't know. Is that?
nanosecond. Trading is nanosecond. So the nanosecond trading, if I have even a minute or two memory, I actually published a paper about this.
Perhaps in view of the time, speaking of nanoseconds, if we could wrap things up here. But Douglas will be around for the rest of today, right? So
yep.
If anyone's interested, we should go out for a dinner at the bistro around 6:30 or something.
Great.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Thank you.